Everything that we want for students to have is predicated on the human teaching them. That's the most powerful lever that exists.
Being able to provide the teachers with opportunities for wellness, and they're getting paid for that, I think is really important.
Our teachers were really making not enough money for survival. And so they're thinking, man, I love my students. I love teaching, but I can't afford a gallon of milk. Funding our schools means funding staff.
If you're not well taken care of and you don't feel safe and you don't feel secure, then you can't give to children. You're already stressed. You're already burnt out. You can't give at home. You can't give to your family. We don't want that.
What role does teacher well-being play in student social and emotional learning? And how do we attend to it? I'm Emily Brookhart, and this is episode 4 of The Power of SEL, where we explore social and emotional learning, otherwise known as SEL, and how it relates to well-being and academic achievement. This podcast is brought to you by Education First in partnership with Novo Foundation. In previous episodes, we've explored what social and emotional learning is, why it's important, how to implement it within classrooms and across districts, and how to navigate through possibly murky political waters and ensure that your SEL practice centers equity. Underpinning all of this, though, is the willingness and ability of educators to do this work. And that piece is so important, we're dedicating a whole episode to it. More than 300,000 public school teachers and staff left the field between February 2020 and May 2022. Prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, 44% of new teachers left the classroom within their first 5 years of teaching. Historically, these turnover rates have been higher for Black and Latina teachers than the national average. Research shows that students of color benefit greatly from having teachers of color. So to recruit and retain teachers, especially teachers of color, it is imperative that we, including district leaders, states, and philanthropy, support their well-being, which is associated with higher rates of teacher commitment and lower rates of burnout and attrition. In today's episode, we'll hear several educators' perspectives on teacher well-being to help us understand the problem and imagine solutions. Let's dive in. First, let's hear from a few familiar voices. Tina Vasquez, an educator in Charlottesville, Virginia, and Dr. Dina Simmons, founder of the organization Liberate Ed, talks to us about the challenges that teachers face.
My name is Tina Vasquez. I am a teacher of newcomer English learners in Charlottesville, Virginia. I've been teaching there almost 20 years, taught a lot of years before that as well, particularly with the teaching shortage. At our school, we have 7 class periods a day, and every teacher teaches 5 classes, has 1 class for planning and 1 for duty period, which usually would be something like setting up in a hallway to supervise. Currently, we don't have enough teachers. We don't have enough substitute teachers. So teachers have to cover for other teachers during their duty and planning periods, which means they can't do that other supervision because they're in another classroom. And they don't even have time to do excellent planning, because that ends up being nights and weekends, and then, you know, our own children don't have enough of us.
What Tina Vasquez is describing in Charlottesville is mirrored nationwide. Schools across the country are facing teacher shortages due to so many teachers leaving the field. Dr. Dina Simmons explains why attending to educators is so critical.
My name is Dina Simmons. I am the founder and executive director of Liberate Ed. We center radical love, healing, and racial and social justice in social-emotional learning and education with the vision of creating a world so that all children could live, learn, and thrive in the comfort of their own skin. At Liberate Ed, we use social-emotional learning as a way to facilitate the conversations that are necessary for teachers to have about what they need as educators to feel free, what they need for their healing, what they need for their care, because we know the saying, heal people, heal people, and hurt people, hurt people. So if we begin to focus on taking care of our educators, then we can do better at taking care of our students. Because when you take care of yourself, when you're modeling for students how to take care of themselves, but you're also modeling how you want other people to treat you. And then our students who are watching and learning also learn how to do that. And so when I think about what teachers need, they need systems that take better care of them. And I always say that a stressed and burnt out teaching force is an equity issue. From research, we know that when teachers are stressed and burnt out, they have less interactions with their students. We also know that students don't do as well academically. And we also know that the social climate suffers. And so now you have students with stressed and burnt out teachers, which, by the way, many teachers feel stressed and burnt out. We say we care about equity and we don't take care of our teachers, then what are we doing? So if we want to take care of our young people, we really got to nourish our teachers. So that's just point blank, take better care of teachers.
Dr. Simmons used the word healing to describe Liberate Ed's approach to meeting teachers' needs. For our purposes, we're going to call it teacher well-being. What exactly is teacher well-being? Cecilia Terrazas is the coordinator of diversity and inclusion in California's Oakland Unified School District.
My role in the district is really to support recruitment and retention of staff of color, and particularly Latino staff. We are a district that has 47% Latino students and 20% Latino staff. So it's a lot of the work that I do to really kind of begin to close that gap. I've been in education for over 25 years. I've been a teacher, was a social studies teacher, was a special education teacher. I taught ethnic studies, which was my favorite. I was a pathway coach and supporter. And then I was an assistant principal, and now I work in recruitment and retention. Teacher well-being to me is really this idea that teachers feel safe, supported, and cared about. I think it's exactly what we want for our students, right? Like, are you in the best environment and supportive system so that you can thrive? And so that's what I'm looking for. That's what I look for as a teacher. Do I feel supported? Do I feel cared about? Do I feel like I can grow and learn? I can make mistakes.
Jared Austin Thomas works alongside Cecilia Terrazas at Oakland Unified and shares a similar definition of teacher well-being, adding that it's important to recognize identity and understand that everyone needs wellness.
I'm Jared Austin Thomas. I am also a coordinator of diversity and inclusion on the recruitment team, supporting the recruitment and retention of our staff in the district, particularly African-American staff. Before this role, I supported the high school networks in Oakland Unified with recruitment and retention. And before that, I was teaching special education in New York, mostly ninth grade math, as well as a few other subject areas. A huge piece of it is recognizing people's humanities and the idea of not separating our students from our teachers, from our staff, and understanding that wellness is something that everybody needs, and positive relationships is what everybody needs, and space to learn and grow and bring their full selves is something that everybody needs. And then being really aware and intentional about the systemic racism that exists in our educational institutions.
Lee Veerstra from Madison Metropolitan School District in Wisconsin has a relatively simple definition of well-being focused on those caring for teachers.
My name is Lee Veerstra, and I'm the current director of innovation for the Madison Public School District. I have been in education now for 18 years, in which 13 of those have been in the classroom. I was for 11 years at one of our high schools here in Madison before transitioning to build the new, well, 5 years new innovation team that I'm now overseeing. You hear a lot of, well, you know, self-care is important and take some time for self-care. But well-being to me is really the value that we have and then the structures in place so that people can take care of themselves and thrive professionally. If I'm a school leader or a district leader and I value my teacher well-being, I'm going to think about what is on my teacher's plates daily and really intentionally schedule my professional learning around that, or think about school structures so that there is that time for self-care, that a teacher is able to go to the bathroom. I mean, I'll tell you, I mean, I was even 2-3 classrooms away from the staff bathroom, and it took me 2 years to actually, and I'm not kidding, realize, oh, wait a second, I don't have to wait for a bell to ring in order to race to the bathroom. Well-being is really just the value that we bring to implementing structures and systems.
And finally, Tamara Uzelman from Fargo Public School District in North Dakota highlights the importance of belonging as she explains teacher well-being.
My name is Tamara Uzelman. I currently am the leadership mentor for Fargo Public Schools. I do that on a kind of a part-time basis. I also work as a professor for a university here in my neck of the woods in an ed leadership program. Prior to that, I've been a director of equity and inclusion. I've been a district superintendent, assistant superintendent, a high school principal, and for a good chunk of my career, a teacher. So I've come full circle. Began as a teacher and I'm sort of ending here as a teacher in the college system. For me, teacher well-being looks like a lot of things. There were teachers who said, I love my school. I won't leave. I will never leave my school. So I said, well, tell me about that. Why would you never leave? And their answer was really concise. Like, I belong there. So I said, well, tell me about that. What does that mean? And they said, our principal does nothing without us. And I think we all know principals have to do all kinds of things without staff, but they were saying the big things, the important things, we're invited to the table. We don't always have to show up, but we're always included. So those qualitative stories of teachers saying, I belong here, I matter here, and I'm willing to dedicate my career here.
These definitions and examples illustrate what well-being can look like. Empathetic school leadership, mental health supports, racial equity, a sense of belonging, teacher autonomy, affinity groups and mentorship, and shared decision-making. What teacher well-being is not has been echoed to us by many educators across the country. Teacher well-being is not the same as individual-focused notions of self-care that might take the form of one-time perks like gift cards, time away from work, or yoga. Well-being is a collective issue rather than an individual responsibility. And while providing a teacher with a massage, for example, might be well received in the moment, it does not address three fundamental contributors to teacher well-being: money, safety, and time. Let's dig deeper with Cecilia Terrazas.
Working conditions is always what is the biggest problem in education. Society in general doesn't recognize the value of educators. And I'd like to argue it has to do because we're primarily female profession. I think that has a lot to do with it. We're caretakers. And so I think it's undervalued and underappreciated. And hence, your working conditions are terrible. Like, we don't have enough money to buy like the basic needs of a classroom. You want to make photocopies. You want to make sure you have access to a working computer, a projector, like pens and pencils. I don't know, the things you really need that are just basic, right? If you think of Maslow's hierarchy, a lot of times teachers don't have their very basic safety needs met. And so that makes for very difficult working conditions. You know, they've got 34 students in a class, but their level of ability is so varied and so wide that it's really hard to teach. And even if you want to teach to all those different varieties of abilities and where people are at, you're one person and you've got over 100 students. I'm thinking, I was a high school teacher, so I think in that manner, but I think we're asking teachers to do a lot. We want them to teach everything under the sun, how to be good humans. We also want to teach them to read. We want them to be good at math. Like, it's just an unreasonable expectation that's really burdened on educators with not a lot of resources to create better working conditions. We are super educated. You have to get a teaching credential. You have to get a master's degree. You have to get a BA, right? But we're not treated like doctors, and not only even in pay, but just like respect and the way we're valued. Because as a society, if we don't start valuing educators, the people who train and invest and love in our next generation, then we're going to run out of them. And that's happening. Like, we see that. And I think there was this precipitous drop after COVID, because it came unmanageable and unwieldy, the amount of need that was required to do this job well.
Lee Veerstra shares a similar sentiment.
One of the things that came out of our research with our teachers is funding is really important. These are highly educated individuals. Many of our teachers, you know, they all have bachelor's, many have master's degrees. And as we all are feeling across the globe, inflation is a thing. Cost of living has risen. In Madison, it is very expensive to live. And our teachers were really making not enough money for survival. And so they're thinking, man, I love my students. I love teaching, but I can't afford a gallon of milk. Funding our schools means funding staff. Our school budgets are, I believe, over 80% staffing costs. Madison has a very light central office. So I think there's a lot of myths around where the, quote, weight is. And yet it's expensive to pay staff, but they are the people educating our kids. And we value education and we know the importance of education. And so it does have a cost. But we also know that when you have strong teachers who are paid a living wage in our classrooms, and not just, you know, first and second year teachers, but you really want teachers who have been there a long time to stay and teach, we have to pay them to do that work. And so our states and our communities need to fund our schools. And that's, you know, depending on the state, that's harder and harder to do.
She also talks about how much time goes into teaching and how much teachers do beyond teaching content.
When you care that deeply about your classroom community, you feel like you have to help them in every way they can. And there's a sense of urgency that you feel, especially for certain students. And that emotionally is a lot to carry. When I was teaching high school, I had 150 students a semester. They would come in and they would tell you about all the things going on in their life. As an educator who understands, you know, systems and processes and has access to various agencies or support, I spent a lot of my time trying to get my students the things they need, whether it be quarters for doing their laundry, food because of food insecurity, counselors because they are going through some stuff in their personal life, tutors because they need extra help in math, whatever it may be. And so you spend so much time thinking about how can you help each and every one of the students. And as a young teacher, when I was starting, I didn't have all those tools and it was very overwhelming. And I was at school until 10, 10:30 at night. I became very good friends with the night custodians.
What's obvious to some that teachers work well past their designated hours to support their students might not be obvious to others.
And I will say this, the number of times I heard, well, you have the summers off. And I was like, yeah, it would take me 6 weeks to recover from the school year. Because when you are in the midst of a school year, it is go time. And you really, when you're spending your weekends grading or lesson planning or, you know, searching for school supplies for your students and whatnot. And so, you know, there's little downtime. In many ways, it's what you love to do, but it does create massive burnout.
Now that we know what teacher well-being can be and how it can make teachers' lives better and easier, it's not hard to see why teacher well-being matters so much. Research shows that teacher well-being not only affects the individual, and you can see a positive ripple effect across classrooms and schools. Well-being is associated with more job satisfaction and better performance, including being able to better model and implement SEL practices in the classroom. Teacher well-being is also associated with better academic outcomes for students and healthier classroom environments that support students' social and emotional learning. Teacher well-being can lead to better school outcomes, including better student-teacher relationships and a more positive school climate. And finally, teacher well-being is a powerful lever to improve teacher retention. Tamara Uzelman agrees.
Everything that we want for students to have is predicated on the human teaching them. That's the most powerful lever that exists. Curriculum is important, right? And standards matter. Outcomes help tell us how we're doing. Yet it is the teacher that is so significant in kids being able to achieve.
Teaching has always been a difficult, though rewarding job. but one event has fundamentally shaken the teaching profession and left lasting effects: the COVID-19 pandemic. More than 300,000 public school teachers and staff left the field between February 2020 and May 2022. And in that time, several states experienced turnover at its highest point in at least 5 years. Research shows that teachers reported higher levels of depression, anxiety, and isolation than other professionals, and those teaching remotely struggled with mental health even more than teachers working in person. All teachers were affected by the pandemic, but teachers of color, who experienced an even higher turnover rate than before the pandemic, and students of color were affected the most. Let's hear from Lee Veerstra about the impact of the pandemic on teachers and their students.
Virtual learning was, as we have seen, a huge challenge, especially in our elementary grades. And, you know, the fears that our students had of interacting with students and being able to talk through frustrations around, oh man, that kid, you know, sat in my seat, or that kid, you know, sneezed and didn't cover their face. Things that all of us, you know, had these like kind of freakouts over. And so for our students, they came back behind like the rest of really the world. But then what we did see is that there were certain populations of students, specifically our Black and Brown students, that came out of the pandemic even more behind than their white peers. So now you're coming into a school setting where teachers are fried because there's so many needs, and the differentiation needs within one classroom were very intense. And how do you support that while covering for classes because a teacher is absent because they are sick, or their child is sick, or there's just a vacancy that has not been hired for?
Lee Veerstra mentioned that teachers were fried. Cecilia Terrazas attributes this at least partially to the overwhelming SEL needs that everyone faced during this time.
I was an administrator when COVID happened, and the world changed in a week. We asked teachers to do things the world hadn't done before. It was intense. It was really hard. We're asking people who are already working countless hours to really now take on social emotional care of young people in a community with a lot of high needs. So it was often overwhelming. Just seeing, again, teachers as human beings, they all also had all of their troubles and struggles and things that they were dealing with that really made social emotional and wellness very challenging during that time. As an administrator at my site, I mean, I hadn't seen that kind of turnover in the 3 years that I had been there. It was really intense. And a lot of people, because they came to visit here, they were working here in Oakland, but they were from the East Coast or from Southern California, were like, I want to be with my family. I don't want to do this. Or they left during COVID because they could, because everything went to Zoom. So we saw a lot of people leave. And so that also exacerbated the teacher shortage. So teachers were overwhelmingly overworked and stressed, not trained to do the job we wanted them to do. We're now social workers, and, you know, we were giving out donations, and teachers were taking laptops to students. I mean, it was crazy. And then they wanted to move and be with their family members. And so some people left the field entirely. So I think, yeah, it's made for a very challenging environment.
Are districts actively implementing practices to support and help retain teachers? The answer is yes. In response to the pandemic's effects on teacher well-being, Education First, with support from Novo Foundation, launched the Teacher Morale and Retention Grant Program. Grants were awarded to school districts and charter schools to use an equitable decision-making framework to help address the unique challenges around teacher morale and retention facing their communities. The equitable decision-making framework focuses on the principle that people most proximate to the problem, in this case, teachers, understand the problems and solutions best, and thus should be both consulted and involved in decision-making processes and conversations that aim to remedy teacher burnout. The grant program concluded in 2023, but the lessons learned were powerful. So powerful, in fact, that through this work, we developed a free equitable decision-making toolkit that districts and schools can use to learn about their communities and come up with solutions centered on teacher well-being together. Visit thepowerofsel.org to learn more. The educators in today's episode were recipients of these teacher morale and retention grants. Let's hear how each of them dove into the issues of teacher well-being. We'll start with Cecilia Terrazas and Jarrett Austin Thomas in Oakland Unified School District. There, they focused on a specific subset of teachers of color, Latina teachers, and brought them together in study sessions to better understand their rights, roles, and options as educators, and to build an active community of support among Latina educators across the district. I should also note that you'll hear folks use the term empathy interviews a lot as they talk about their grant work. Empathy interviews are one-on-one conversations designed with open-ended questions to elicit stories and experiences from interviewees. The toolkit we developed includes resources you can use to conduct empathy interviews yourself. Now, you'll hear how powerful they were for the work of these grantees.
This grant really allowed us to pay people for their time, especially for people of color, that a lot of our work is unseen and undervalued, that it really means a lot. We had veteran teachers who were like, wow, and this is a good amount of money. We appreciate it. Like, you know, it was like, yeah, I don't just expect you to just be here. We paid people who we were doing empathy interviews for. Like, you gave us half an hour. We're going to pay you for your time. And I think, you know, people feel seen in that way. And it's just really important. Like, I value you. Like, it's a way to say I'm valued, even if it's not a lot, but it's something. Educators, we're so passionate. And so then it's kind of like they take advantage of our passion and don't really pay us for all the time we put into it.
In addition to compensating teachers for their work with the grant activities, Oakland Unified School District set up systems to provide professional and personal community for their teachers. And this went a particularly long way for the many teachers of color in the district.
We worked to come up with a plan where we shrunk down the scope of the project to feeder schools in one neighborhood where there was maybe the largest, but a really large percentage of the student population identify as Latino. And then I would say comparatively, there's probably a higher percentage of teachers that also identify as Latino in that space, but the disparity was still as large as what we face in the majority of the district. And so it was a really great opportunity for us to be able to support Latino teachers and really focus our effort where our greatest disparity exists, while also keeping it in one neighborhood where we can really sort of like track how this neighborhood compares with the rest of the district, how the participating teachers in that neighborhood compare with other teachers that might not participate in that neighborhood, and then provide those teachers with opportunities for wellness, opportunities for additional stipends, opportunities to like learn about themselves and about the district and about just education as a whole. And so we are doing learning sessions monthly, intermixed with a couple of like sort of celebratory and wellness events. And it provides these teachers with an opportunity to build community with other teachers at schools that in theory, their students are going to sort of progress through. And then also receive some compensation for their participation in it. And I would say that that is another sort of piece of education, is the work is very, very rewarding, but the work shouldn't be like the only compensation. And so being able to provide the teachers with opportunities for wellness and they're getting paid for that, I think is really important because like their time is very limited based on the amount of work that they have to do and the amount of time that they spend out of the classroom, technically not getting paid for the work that they're doing. It's nice to be able to say, hey, can you come do this other thing? And also like, here is some compensation for that other thing.
So what we've been doing in these learning sessions have been a couple fold. One is like really trying to build a professional community. And so we do activities for folks to really get to know each other. we break bread, so we're eating and really kind of just sharing stories. We've also been going to different sites so that other teachers get to learn about other part of their feeder schools. Oh, our students went here, or our students are going to go here. And so it's all of the setup has been really intentional to really kind of just build this like professional network in this community of Latino educators that are really serving all the same young people. So that was one thing. The other thing is we wanted to make sure, because in our empathy interviews, one of the things we identified as an issue was access to information. A lot of people felt that there were gatekeepers, and so they didn't have access to certain information. So we developed some sessions around, like, we brought in the union president to talk about what are your rights within the contract? What are ways you can file a grievance? How can you get extended professional development? So like a whole variety of things that really kind of help and arm teachers to be their own self-advocate. The other thing we did is we invited someone from our credentials office, because we have some newer teachers, and really knowing what's the process. How do you make more money? Like, you can make more money in education if you like get more units and you're able to move along the path. A lot of people don't know that. And so really learning how to do that is really critical, as well as like, what are your other professional development units? Who can you call when, you know, to turn in your transcripts? Like some of the little things to big things about, can I get a stipend when I get a master's, and where do I go for, and what school is the best to get my teaching credentials? So a variety of different things.
In addition to supporting the administrative side of the work, Oakland also focused on sharing stories, personal experiences, and healing practices for Latina educators.
And then we had some veteran Latina teachers just talk about their experience. The staff loved it. They were like, oh, wow, I want to hear more, like learning about their different just passions. And then some of the other ones we did so far is around, like, we have a series of three, like focused on particular wellness. So there's some that are like that, more educational, and then some that are wellness focused. And so we invited someone to come in who really practices like Native Indigenous healing practices along with like psychotherapy, but we wanted it to be more activity based. And so he came in for the first session, and we did the four directions and Indigenous culture, and we journaled and we drew, and it just felt like really powerful reflections for people to like heal. Even in this moment, as educators of color, we're in this white supremacist society where we're constantly having generational and racial trauma on top of us. So this piece of healing is critical to the development of a strong sense of self, and to be able to support the healing of our babies who we know come to us with a lot of the same societal burdens and racial burdens and traumas that impact their lives. And so we've created also a series of healing-centered activities to really give educators a time to stop, not learn how to heal young people, practice, actually not learn, practice healing themselves. And so that's been really critical as well.
Identity also plays a part in supporting the well-being of teachers of color.
We also contracted somebody who does ethnic studies work, and he's going to help us think about, one, just like how your sense of identity has developed as Latinos over the years. And then another workshop designed talking about like the history of Black and Brown unity, because I think that's another component in our district, is this tension around fighting for resources between the Black and Brown community. And so then like, how do we really talk about all the ways we have similarities and all the things we share to kind of create more unity? And for those, we'll actually invite Black educators as well to be part of that learning session together, as a, like a, we're going to actually do some of the unity building in unison. This is super important to me. Teacher wellness and teacher well-being, as well as administrator, but we talk about that less, but it's really key, right? If all educators, whoever you are, if you're not well taken care of and you don't feel safe and you don't feel secure, then you can't give to children. You're already stressed. You're already burnt out. You can't give at home. You can't give to your family. We don't want that. That's not what's going to serve best our students. Our students really need strong, stable adults who are happy and want to encourage them in their lives. Of course, there's like the racial equity issues that changes it, but I just think this overall blanket teacher wellness was just super important to me. I want teachers to feel recognized and celebrated and happy. We're not here because we're millionaires. Our work is important and it's urgent, and I really want people to feel safe in their role.
Cecilia Terrazas shares a powerful example of how Oakland Unified used SEL to provide a much needed space for their teachers of color.
How do you have safe spaces for Latinos, and how do you have safe spaces for African-American teachers and students, and build and make sure folks feel safe, supported, secure, happy? And then how do you also learn about each other? How can we also confront some of our stereotypes and our challenges openly and honestly in community? So I think having those spaces that are separate, that are needed, and also really integrating Black and Brown folks in common goals. And especially if they're centered around our young people, how do you center their experience, but also ours as teachers of color?
Cecilia Terrazas gives an example about how she and Jared Austin Thomas created this in their district.
Jared and I did host a Brown and Black affinity space. We called it the Healing Center Teaching and Learning. And it brought Brown and Black special education educators together. And we really focused on building community, somatic wellness, consistent, doing that every time we met. And then we did something around talking about what are some of the societal structures that can get in the way of learning, get in the way of educating, and then how do we heal from some of those? And then by extension, how do we heal that with our students? And so it was this really beautiful series, and we held it on a Friday, which is crazy. We did it on Zoom, maybe from 5 to 7 on Fridays. I don't know who wants to do that on Friday, but people showed up consistently and people were like, I just want to come. And I had a really hard day and I knew this would make me feel better. I felt so honored that we created a space that folks could feel connected and they were learning about each other. We also invited Brown and Black students who had IEPs, and they treated them as equals in the classroom. It was really beautiful. Sometimes it's just like SEL and healing is just bearing witness to each other's struggles and to each other's pain.
This demonstrates not only how important and simple attending to teacher well-being can be, but also how SEL is often the lifeline that keeps teachers in the classroom. Katie Raymond, a teacher in Austin, Texas, describes her experience.
I don't know if I hadn't found SEL if I would still be in the job, because as much as I love students, I love them so much. I love the joy the job brings me. I love the job. I love teaching. I love creating. But without the support to really dive into that, I don't know that I could keep doing it. So I'm really happy to have a space to do that. And it's just everything. That's what we're all there for. Why would anyone do this if we didn't actually think there was change happening for the better? That being said, it is not enough change. And I really struggle with being content with like what power I have and being proud of that with the lack of change that I'm seeing. It's just a system that's real gross, for lack of a better word, to walk around in.
In Madison, Lee Veerstra and her team listened to their teachers and are coming up with innovative ways to provide them with another much needed but hard to come by resource, time.
Over the last almost 2 years, our team has worked with a variety of elementary schools around the district to really understand what is going on with our teachers and what is it that they actually need, want, and desire. And we wanted to really validate or check our assumptions through surveys and then direct interviews with our staff. And we learned that our staff really feels overwhelmed with time and the ability to support the great social emotional needs of our students, especially coming out of a pandemic, and the academic needs. I mean, and those are things that, you know, teachers have been saying far beyond the pandemic, but they were so exacerbated by it. And so it was this piece of, well, what can we do to kind of address the things that we actually have control over? So we worked with teachers and school-based leaders at two of the elementary schools to do small-scale proto-testing. And we built what we call the Collab Labs. And that is 3 hours of planning time that our teachers have together as a grade-level team. And planning is kind of the broad term, they actually meet with our student services team to talk through student problems and actually create action plans. They look at student data in order to inform instruction, and then they plan from that. And it has been hugely valuable to our staff, so much so that actually that project has now gone from 2 schools and we've scaled it to 7. However, I learned that some of our other elementary schools are doing this because they heard such positive things from the schools that are actually participating in the project.
Problem solving and innovating solutions to give teachers more time has led to some surprising and unintended positive impacts on students and other staff.
One of the things that has been hugely important is how those hours are covered, because the idea is that we don't want to add stress to teachers. That would defeat the project, right? And so one of the big learnings was that we can't ask teachers to write their own, quote, sub plans for those 3 hours. And so we have buddy classrooms. That was actually a very positive unintended consequence, in which the students in like first grade have fourth grade buddies. And so they go into each other's classrooms during this time, so twice a month, and the students love it. I actually have a friend whose kids are at one of the schools, and they just talk about, oh, I get to see my buddies today, or I got to do this activity with my buddy, which is amazing. And what we have seen is actually there is a stronger school-wide community because of those buddy classrooms. Everything we looked at is like, okay, so we're going to have an extra 20-ish kids coming into another classroom. Will that classroom teacher feel overwhelmed to support this number of students, right? Or will they see it as a positive? So it's things like that that we're looking at. The other thing that many schools are doing, not all, is covering one of the 3 hours with our student supports team, so psych and social workers, to actually teach a CELS lesson. You know, again, we were concerned. Staff are already overwhelmed. They already have a lot on their plates, especially our student services team. What is it that we can do to support them? And some of our psych and social workers have said, actually being in a classroom and seeing how students are engaging with their peers has been hugely valuable.
But some factors that contribute to decreased well-being are not even in the hands of a school district, which highlights how important intentionality behind teacher well-being is at every level of the system, all the way from the federal level to the school level.
Districts are under their own stress, so I don't want to say that our district leaders are causing this, because in the state of Wisconsin, our state legislature has very tight restrictions that really hamper a school district's ability to be innovative about their calendar or their schedule. And so if we have to start school at a certain day of the year, and we have to hit a certain number of instructional minutes based on level throughout the year, it's very challenging to find time to give our staff professional development for the things that they need. It's very challenging to think about setting up a school day structure so that our teachers aren't working 15 hours a day. It's from the top and it goes every level down. When you are in the classroom on the ground, you look to the people above you to help, to make changes, and then they look to the people above that. But Wisconsin, we are tightly regulated by our legislature, and it has been really hard for schools. And that goes all into education policy, which, again, a whole nother podcast. So many of us don't know about how state policies actually impact education. And I think just policies in general. I mean, this is part of my job is the implementation of things. We're testing to see if our great idea actually makes the difference that we want on the ground. And this is where my frustration comes in. Great idea from a policy standpoint. And yet, if you're not on the ground looking at how it's actually rolled out and its ultimate impact, then we failed. And so I think so much of policy, we don't think about those unintended consequences.
Lee Veerstra notes that even if implementing a teacher well-being program isn't possible for every district, small changes can still go a long way.
I very much believe that we work with our teachers, not for our teachers. And so we have these design teams that are made up of the people that are most impacted, the key stakeholders, and we pay them. And they have to be paid to do this work. I don't believe in teachers volunteering to improve their professional experience. And we also feed them, because a lot of the work now is done in the evenings because we have sub shortages. And so the funding from Novo Ed has been hugely valuable to not only paying our staff to do this work, to find solutions, but to also have the supplies and the resources and the support they need to actually engage in the work. What our teachers were asking for was so minimal. They asked for coffee and tea during meetings and some snacks. Those are two critical elements of just survival as a human, right? Food and hydration, right? They were not asking for a lot. Yeah, I think that that's also a myth that our teachers are going to ask for unnecessary things.
Finally, let's return to Tamara Uzelman in Fargo Public Schools, who found that the practice of listening is an excellent way to support teacher well-being and offers opportunities for teachers to explore and grow.
I think we received $50,000 from the Novo Foundation. You know, our budget is probably $220 million. So it lets you know $50,000 is significant. Like, that's a nice chunk of cash and you're not going to misuse it, right? Yet it's not going to fix every system problem. And selfishly, what this Novo Foundation grant did is teach us how to listen to our people. Even when we sat down and a number of us interviewed 300 teachers, and the pain points that they expressed were real and they hurt to hear because they're talking about some of our work, right? But what that grant did is really teach us the importance of constructivist listening. We have replicated that in multiple places. I gave you the example of the standard-based ed director who's working with the union now and just listening to teacher groups. We're planning to do that with some special education staff as well. We've built it into almost every meeting where the participants actually are engaged in that way. So long story short, that grant allowed us the opportunity to develop what I might call a little bit or a pilot project. And then to take everything we've learned from that pilot and use it so often that empathy interviews or constructivist listening, now they're part of our vocabulary.
Listening can be healing. And even when the listener can't change systems, they can amplify voices.
When we began our project, I think we listened to 300 teachers and we were able to theme what the concerns were. And some we couldn't touch, like we don't have the power to increase salary or to add additional staff. But we have the power to share that messaging with people who need to hear. So by listening and then theming and then trying to figure out now, is that a symptom of a problem or is that the problem, helps us respond better. The other thing that I think matters is we don't have to fix everything. Sometimes we just simply need to listen to people and then ask them how collectively do we come up with a solution. I think people want to be part of a solution, not just a receiver of yet another initiative.
Fargo Public Schools also used the Morale and Retention Grant to encourage teachers to practice inquiry and pay them for doing so.
The Novo grant provided funds to do a poster session to celebrate the work of teachers. They did these wonderment projects, right? And so they actually had paid time to just practice inquiry, like what is something you wonder about? And they were guided through a wonderment course and then did public presentations on their work.
The practices that Fargo Public Schools have implemented with their teachers, practices like constructivist listening and exploration, are having an impact on students too.
And again, teachers can't give what they don't possess. So when you spend time swimming in equity and swimming in constructivist listening practices, I think they're better able to replicate that in their class. So it really was a seedling, I would say, that is sprouting up now in multiple places in a very big district, but it's becoming part of our lingua franca. That's a sign that the system is adopting that methodology. We have to make public education relevant. Well, we don't have to, but if we were smart, we'd make public education relevant. We still educate most of the nation's children. And we need to realize that, you know, like when I was in school, it was all about preparing for the future. And today's kids actually want to have a life right now, too. And so education has to be relevant now. Whether we like it or we don't like it, that's just a fact. So then how can we provide our educators a respectful amount of time and an opportunity to learn themselves so that they feel whole and human and valued? And, you know, we have a couple examples of where that works better than not. We've done the building assets, reducing risks, kind of culture change in one high school, and now it's moved to a middle school and several elementary schools. So those are examples of really investing in staff and allowing them time to problem solve with kids at the same time as the central office leadership works on how do we create a more equitable system in education.
Teacher well-being and SEL go hand in hand. And just like we learned with SEL for students, there are so many pathways to support teacher well-being and so many ways that it can look. In many cases, additional time and money are needed, but a little bit can go a long way. And solutions for improving teacher well-being work best when all levels of the system are putting in effort to make a change, not just a school or a school district. Districts across the country are trying and succeeding to improve teacher well-being, especially after the pandemic, and we hope this episode gave you a small idea of how. The Power of SEL is brought to you by Nova Foundation, Education First, and Big Duck. Special thanks to our guests, Jarrett Austin Thomas, Dr. Dina Simmons, Cecilia Terrazas, Tamara Uzelman, Katie Raymond, Tina Vasquez, and Lee Veerstra. Our Education First production and writing team is Chad Rubicaba, Brinny Ramsey, Fatima Omar, and Aaron Papelka. From Big Duck, strategic guidance is by Farah Trompeter, artwork design by Claire Taylor Hansen, copywriting by Nicole Tufts, project management by Brenda Perez, and recording, editing, and sound design by Marcus DePaula. Music is by Cody Martin. This podcast is made possible because of the work of the SEL in Action Fund grantees, who you can learn more about at thepowerofsel.org. I'm Emily Brookhart. Thank you for joining us on this journey of exploring well-being and academic achievement through social and emotional learning on the Power of SEL. Join us next time for our final episode in this series, where we'll be looking at philanthropy and funders and their role in supporting SEL and teacher well-being.